This is the New Criterion. I'm James Panero, executive editor. At once barrier and route, the Thames has been crucial to London's history, development, identity, and imagination. It helps explain much about London's role in the history of England and that city's leading place in Britain's interaction with the wider world. So we read in River of Destinies, a feature on the role of the Thames in England's fortunes in the February 2024 issue of The New Criterion by our guest today, Jeremy Black. Jeremy, welcome.
Hello, and delighted to be on with you.
Jeremy has been writing for The New Criterion since January 2008. River of Destinies is his 34th article for the magazine. 34 articles on British and American history, covering international relations, commerce, transportation, war, and much more, would be impressive just on its own. But Jeremy Black, who has been described as the most prolific historical scholar of our age, is also the author of over 180 books. This prodigious output means that he writes faster than many people read, so I'm particularly pleased that he has taken the time out from his work to join us today from his home in Exeter. Did I get that number right, 180?
You did get the number right, James. On top of that, my links with the New Criterion extend to the fact I've come to New York on a number of occasions and taken part in the excellent conferences that you have sponsored, and also had the opportunity to meet many of your subscribers accordingly.
Well, we need to do those again. I agree. Let's hear a little more about River of Destinies. Would you read a passage from the article for us?
Well, what I'd like to do, because the New Criterion sits not just as a major journal of American intellectual history, but also as probably the major journal of Atlantic intellectual studies, with a range that encompasses Britain, and indeed the Anglosphere as a whole. And I'd like to read a passage accordingly from T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is particularly appropriate because he was an American, of course, educated in America, who came to London in 1915 and essentially made his home there. And from that background, he became what I would say is one of the leading Christian writers of the 20th century, and as such, an important figure who it's overly easy to lose sight of when people are so much more fascinated with, as it were, the Virginia Woolfs of the age. Now, The Wasteland, which in many respects is the most famous work by Eliot, justifiably so, was not only written in London, but also makes much of the Thames. It encompasses within it an account of the river as in part a matter of the sadness of modern life, the detritus of immorality and rubbish. But there is also in it a sense, an intimation of a better future. And I'd like to read suggestions of that from The Wasteland. I don't claim to have a great voice, but what I'm going to try to do is to capture, at least by giving you some of Eliot's phrases, this idea of the river as central to the imaginative identity of a country. And that, I think, is important. It begins: "This music crept by me upon the waters, and along the Strand, up Queen Victoria Street. O city, city, I can sometimes hear, besides a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin, and a clatter and a chatter from within, where fishmen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendour of Ionian white and gold. Elizabeth and Leicester, beating oars, the stern was formed. A gilded shell, the peal of bells, white towers." Now, if you go along to the Thames side in London now, Magnus Martyr survived the Blitz, and it still has that element that Eliot captured. And what's interesting to me is for those of us who have a sense of culture as a continuity, and I see that very strongly in the new criterion and the way in which it offers these amazing articles on by in which the cultural presence of the moment is actually interrogated in terms of a much longer set of assumptions and questions. I think if you have that background, you can see along the Thames this kind of reference, this kind of, as it were, the different layers of an oil painting. And in part, what I tried to do in my article was to, as it were, offer both a realist account of the Thames, if you like, and discuss it in terms of trade and power, of London as the centre of, for long, the centre of the Anglosphere, before New York became the world city, as it now is. I wanted to talk both about that, but also about the way in which the city, the buildings, the culture captured a civilization. And it's there in all sorts of ways. It's there, for example, in Sherlock Holmes, The Sign of Four, which came out just after the films came out, the silent film came out just after The Wasteland, and it showed a spectacular boat chase down the Thames. Again, another film of the 20s, Blackmail by Alfred Hitchcock, the first British talkie, featured exteriors of the British Museum. So there was both the Thames and the buildings along it and on it with their sense of continuity from the past. But there was also the Thames as a sign of the modern. When Peter the Great came to London, he came to see warships being built and East Indiamen, mighty ships being built at the Thameside shipyards at Deptford. When travellers came to London in the 18th century, they were excited, as they were in the 19th century, by the shock of the new. Not so long ago, I read a French guidebook to England from 1740, 120 pages, 112 of those pages were devoted to London. And for French visitors of the 18th century, people like Voltaire and Montesquieu, both of whom lived in London for a number of years, it was London as the city of the new that was striking. And of course, the Thames captured that. One of the great achievements of the 18th century was the new bridge with its dramatic span across the Thames at Westminster. And it was the second bridge across the Thames. And it was followed by other bridges in the 18th century, Blackfriars, for example. Also on the Thames, you had the centre of British maritime power and astronomical understanding of the outer world at Greenwich. You had the great international chartered companies, the East India Company, the Russia Company, the Hudson Bay Company, all of them based there. And what one has got, in other words, is a sense of the mould being broken. So you have these two parts to London. You have Eliot with his sense of continuity, with his sense of the hidden corners, with his sense of these sounds that you can hear, and that wonderful image that I quoted to you about the music creeping by along the waters and being able to hear in a public bar the sound of the past. You have that. But you also, of course, have this breaking of the mould, and both continue. I mean, the Eliot reference to Elizabeth and Leicester, that's Elizabeth I and her favourite, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, was captured in a way when the last monarch, Elizabeth II, actually went. I was there. I saw the episode. It was a terrible rainy day, in fact. Went in a barge up the river. Actually, down the river, I should say, because it was towards the mouth. Down the river. In a similar, in a way, reenactment of that, though, of course, there was no equivalent to the Earl of Leicester. I think in many senses it's rather funny, but we live, we claim to live in a sort of more loose world in some respects. We actually live in a much more straight-laced world than much of the past, but that's another matter.
Well, thank you so much for starting with T.S. Eliot, really our forefather here, having founded the Criterion magazine from which we get our name. I want to go back to the beginning of London, which I believe is approaching its 2000th birthday around
Yes.
since Roman settlement of Londinium was around 43 AD. What attracted the Romans to this site, and what has allowed it to prosper beyond other rivers and ports?
The Romans were attracted to London because it represented a crossing point over the Thames. The Thames, of course, is an east-west river. It is an obstacle. You need to find a crossing point. And there were essentially two, if you like, protuberances of sort of firmer ground on which you could lay the foundations of a bridge. And that was really very important. There were two gravel beds on either side of the river. On top of that, boats could sail up the estuary of the Thames. And as it were, Londinium is where the lowest point where you could cross the river and the highest point where it was convenient for seagoing ships to sail to.
And
So
is
it
this around where the city of London is today?
absolutely. Absolutely. And that represented the position, and it then became obviously a fortified base because although Roman London for most of its history was peaceful, of course, it was actually destroyed by Boadicea or Boudica, the Queen of the Iceni, soon after it was founded. Rather ironic that, of course, there's a Victorian statue of her on the banks of the river. As yet, those who want to dislodge statues haven't got round to her, but I can't see them somehow doing it because although she was responsible for killing a lot of people, she was an anti-imperialist, tick one, and of course a woman, tick two. So I think the statue of Boadicea will be there as long as probably the Nelson Mandela that one, and nobody else probably.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they've gone after statues of Abraham Lincoln here, so no one's safe.
No one.
As a seaport, you write that London entered a decline soon after World War II. And the same thing happened to New York and other maritime cities, but not all. Rotterdam has only grown as a modern trading hub. Instead, we have docklands that have been converted into trading floors for the financial services industry, Canary Wharf in London, Wall Street in New York. Is this the natural evolution of maritime cities, the continuation of trade by other means? Or do you think London and New York should rethink its relationships to their rivers?
Well, that's a brilliant question. I think in the case of both New York and London, they were hit hard by overly powerful unions, trade unions in the docks. And I think that was a real problem. Rotterdam, of course, didn't have that problem. Rotterdam was therefore able to embrace containerization, just as on the East Coast of America, some ports, Newport, for example, sorry, Norfolk, some ports, Newport News, have done, made a much better fist of embracing containerization. In a way, both London and New York continue to be major trading centres. They trade money on a daily basis far more than they actually trade any goods. But goods themselves are in part brought in now by aircraft, and you can see around Kennedy or around Heathrow, industrial estates. You can see, as it were, high value, low bulk goods that are being processed and distributed. So, in part, what one has got is a different form of transport. But as a difficulty of that is that both of those cities have, as it were, turned their backs on the river. And in the case of New York, which was a city much more as it were, close to the mouth of its river system. It's more dramatic. The turn is a more dramatic one. I think that's dangerous, not just aesthetically and culturally. I also think it's dangerous in the sense that the rivers help to give these places identity and shape and meaning. And now they're more like anywhere, a big version of anywhere, but anywhere. I tried to explain this both in my article for you and also in my brief history of London. What I found interesting was the way in which you can make most points by reference to literary works and other cultural products. In other words, the river has fascinated people. If you think of 19th century paintings of New York or 19th century paintings of London, whether by, for example, Turner, but also by French visitors like Monet, there are many, many paintings of the river. And the river, in a way, was particularly attractive to them because it posed a shape-defying essence, that in a sense you could use the river with colour, with cloud, you could use it in order to probe what shapes were, to probe, as it were, identities in a way that's much harder to do on land.
It's a framing device, in a way.
It's a framing device, but it's also an aesthetic. It's an aesthetic in a way that is very interesting, because classically marine painting is the marine painting of out to sea, a storm. But actually there is also that form of marine painting located in cities. So, for example, in New York, the paintings of Brooklyn Bridge as it went up. In London, for 18th century London, for example, there are the canvases by Canaletto, who visited London and presented London as it were, the modern Venice, and was able to do that because the river was so important in London. And in the 19th century, I think what one could say is that Monet's paintings of the Thames, and particularly the differing views of the bridges and of the Houses of Parliament, is impressionism in a way that is much more dramatic than, shall we say, dealing with scenes of water lilies or the equivalent, or hay racks.
Durant tried to copy the success of those paintings, and I read that he was dismayed by the light that he received when he was trying to paint London.
Yes, I mean, London's not an easy place to paint, and of course now I would say it's a much harder place for an artist to, as it were, compose, because there is the cacophony of noise, again, like New York. And Eliot is trying to suggest that there are these magical places where you can go through time. I mean, in a way, he's offering a dark holes account of the city. And that's what makes it so fascinating, The Wasteland, and more generally his work, because he is consciously trying to move through time. Another American writer who did that in a very different genre is the detective writer John Dixon Carr, who wrote a number of, you know, famous novelist, most of his novels set in the London of the 30s and 40s, but he wrote a number of novels in which his characters, there's one in particular set in the Tower of London, go through time. And, as it were, pop up into the 17th century. And again, clearly for American visitors, London offered this possibility to break through the constraints of time in order to discover a past which was also their past. I think that's the important thing, that the Thames, for Americans, was their past, because whether or not they were of British antecedents, and of course the English are one of the biggest, if not the biggest, minority in the United States. Whether or not they were of English antecedents, there was a culture there. The Authorized Version of the Bible, Shakespeare, the great works of common law, there was a culture there which came from Thameside, and therefore in a way they would understanding themselves by understanding the Thames. I mean, you know, the American fascination with Shakespeare was very, very, very strong in the first two-thirds of the 20th century, but even continues after that. It's Sam Wanamaker who's responsible for for rebuilding the globe on the side of the Thames. And, you know, it was a great triumph of, if you like, American enterprise there. And if you go there, you will find, whether or not you approve of the performances, some of which take Shakespeare, in my view, too far, but what you will notice is the two prime constituent groups in the audience are Brits and Americans. And the Americans are there not just to spectate, but they're there to participate in their culture.
Well, and of course, Connecticut, we have New London, Connecticut, with what is called there the Thames River, spelled the same as Thames, and nearby is Stratford. So yes, it's right on our map. We put it right into our landscape.
Going up the Thames, I think I've done it once in a boat. Am I not right that up there is the house that was built for the great Sherlock Holmes actor, the great American who did Sherlock Holmes in the 19-teens and 20s and built a sort of fortress-style house along the river? And, I mean, it's very interesting. If you go up those Connecticut rivers, you will find so many places that echo. Now, it has to be said that the idea which Gibbon had, you know, Gibbon asks this question, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon, of course, from a London background, in book four of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is written during the American War of Independence, he actually addresses the question, and remember, he's a member of Parliament as well as a writer. He addresses the question, will civilization succumb again? And he sees the challenge to civilization as coming out of Asia. You know, he's asking, will the current European civilization succumb as the Roman world had succumbed? And what he says is he doesn't think that's going to happen, and he explains why. But he adds, it doesn't matter if it happens, because civilization has already been reborn on the other side of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll leave aside the fact he'd probably get shot these days for that sort of cultural notion. What Gibbon is capturing is the idea, very strong classical idea, which went on in the post-classical world, of, as it were, the what was called the translation of the empires. There's a Latin tag for it. The idea that civilizations succeed each other, but do so successfully by adapting and moving beyond what the previous civilization had done. And the point is, so the notion was, for example, that the Renaissance had built on the classical world and so on. The Brits had this notion that they were the modern Romans, but of course that idea was then taken over by and on behalf of the Americans, by the Americans, because many Americans believed this as well, and there was a very strong sense, I mean, not least in the visual display of American culture, in the names of institutions like the Senate, for example. But it was also not just by the Americans, but on behalf of the Americans, because many Brits had this notion of declinism as affecting Britain from the late 18th century onwards. Not all of them did. And they classically saw the future as laying on the other side of the Atlantic. And that's very, very interesting because, of course, the city that comes to symbolize America to the Brits is New York, for good and ill. I mean, there are some aspects that they don't like. I mean, if you look at Charles Dickens, he's both pro and critical. But nevertheless, there is this strong sense that this is a much more dynamic society and one more open to talent. But the interesting thing is they're both river cities. Both London and New York are river cities. And to the British, New York was the real capital of America, not Washington.
Well, and the Dutch, of course, traded away the island of Manhattan for an island in New Guinea with the British to corner the nutmeg trade, which might be considered the worst deal ever made with the Dutch. I want to ask about your research and writing style. Some historians might take 25 years to write a single book. You might take 1 year to write 25 books.
No, not 1 year to write 25 books, but I do write a lot. Can I just say, I mean, obviously I'm presented as a kind of freak because I write such a lot. And I imagine when I die, if I deserve an obituary, people will focus on that. I actually think that's a pity because one's neither better nor worse for writing a lot or for not writing a lot. What I think is interesting about my work is the intellectual ambition. That, I think, is what's really unusual, the willingness to range widely, the willingness to try and take on board what others have done, but also to add to it. And precisely as you say, because I've ranged widely, one could, as it were, draw on different things. But there is a strong intellectual ambition. And part of it is very much along the line of what the New Criterion does. I mean, I've written a series of works, all of them published by American houses, in fact, by Indiana, by St. Augustine, by Roman and Littlefield, in which I have looked at major writers who I feel are being wrongly modernized and tried to put them in their context, the context of the age, the context of their values. Now, some of these are famous writers. So with Indiana, I did a Shakespeare, I did a Jane Austen. Others of them are what people who might be famous to you and I and to the general public, but tend to be snubbed by the academy. Agatha Christie, for example, another interesting example of an Anglo-American, incidentally, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Ian Fleming. And what I've tried to do, and I've just got a book out on the neo-Gothic, and I've also...
Yes, I want to quote that. So from St. Augustine Press, The Age of Nightmare.
Yeah, I've also done with them a book on Henry Fielding, a book on Tobias Smollett. These days, nobody can talk about Smollett because his wife owned slaves. And a book on Daniel Defoe's coming out. Now, the point is, what I'm trying to do is to say that these writers are important. Some of them are explicitly conservative. Agatha Christie is a very much a conservative writer and a devout Anglican. Some of them are not necessarily explicitly conservative, but have conservative concerns and concerns with continuity. And I'm trying to offer a different reading of the cultural continuity, and in particular to capture the religiosity. The book on Austin very much presents Austin as somebody who is not some kind of proto-romantic, but as a classic daughter of the church, a very, you know, a devout Anglican, somebody that wrote prayers. The book that you mentioned on the neo-Gothic, I want to argue that in it, and I go in it from the Castle of Otranto to Dracula and the Hound of the Baskervilles, I want to argue in it, and I do argue in it, that this idea in the real presence of evil, something in which actually Agatha Christie shares, and in his own way so does Ian Fleming, the notion of the real presence of evil is crucial if you're to have a sense of good. I mean, otherwise, good is a form of social work, as it were. And I think that this is something that we've lost sight of. Whether people are personally devout or not is not the key point here. The key point is that they understand why a notion of belief has been so important to our cultural continuity. And again, if you're looking at T.S. Eliot, T.S. Eliot makes no sense outside a Christian context. Can I just add a sentence that I think to link into the new criterion here?
Please do.
To my mind, one aspect of which my work tries to emulate what the new criterion offers is that we're both opposed to presentism. Now, presentism has all sorts of challenges to cultural value, because what it essentially proposes is that the inherited cultural assumptions, which are the only ways in which you can understand the past and all the works of them, are to be jettisoned in favour of a fascination with the present. Now, inherently, a fascination with the present is a fascination that is narcissistic, whereas an interest in what people, let us say, understood a 19th century novel to mean, or what they thought the idea of the soul was in as late as, shall we say, the 1950s, and how that influenced both writing and reading, those kind of ideas are lost if you're only interested in present-day values. So to me, history is not about academic historians, nor is it about necessarily what we classically think of as the discipline of history. History is those people who are concerned to understand the values of the past and how those both illuminate the past and also influence the present. And you don't have to be an academic to do that, and you don't have to be what is classically called a historian.
Well, that's so well said and very much in line with what we do here at the magazine, as you say. What do you think future historians will say of this age we're in? Is it a kind of a Jacobin moment?
Well, I certainly think it is. I mean, I'm afraid to say if you're thinking of academic historians, they're overwhelmingly on the left, so they will provide overwhelmingly views accordingly. I've tried to do in my book, A Brief History of History, which Indiana published last year. I've tried, though, to propose the notion that the key interpreters of history are not the academics. It is broader public currents for both good and ill. So, for example, if you're looking at the aspects that fascinate most people in the United States and Britain about history, it's genealogy. It's finding out about themselves, and also a broader notion of genealogy, finding out about their community or other aspects of the communities that they belong to. And I think in a way, history is about a sense of value, which is why it is so challenging to the totalitarians on the left, and in some respects, the totalitarians on the right as well. But the totalitarians on the left tend to be much more strongly presentist, whereas the totalitarians on the right tend to be of the blood and soil type. So they offer a sort of rather perverse reading of the past, whereas those on the left try and forget about the past completely, you know, and logically with Pol Pot or with the enormous destruction of, let us say, the past under, say, Lenin or the communists when they took over Eastern Europe. Now, if one's thinking about history today, the question and how it's going to look in the future, the question in the future one has to concern oneself with is what freedom exists to both express opinions in whatever age we're thinking of and to scrutinize the past. Now, there may, in some respects, the scrutiny of the past may be odd. So, for example, I was not so long ago at a building in London where they'd removed those paintings in which the subjects of the portraits were holding cigarettes. Now, that to me is a classic example of something that is an absurdity, but is less serious than if you take out entire writers or entire forms of literature because you do not like them or you do not regard them as valid or viable.
Well, and there is this countercultural moment here, I think, when it comes to history with the popularity of history podcasts. You do one yourself.
Yes.
It's very popular. Black's History Week, from you can listen to it at the Critic magazine. It's terrific. Here you cover British turnpikes and railroads and much else, and you're approaching your 170th episode. How did this series come about?
It came about because I was very frustrated with the nature of the British academic profession. I mean, really frustrated. And I retired, I think before they could sack me, but I retired and I still wanted to reach out. And I just thought, right, let us try and bypass the academic networks and produce podcasts. And essentially, one of the great things about podcasts, one of the great things about what we're doing now, is that people can listen to us without having to go through the power system of the profession. Now, the power system of the profession is absurd anyway, in many terms, in terms of the language it uses, in terms of its opaque ideas, and in terms, quite frankly, in some respects, of views that are at best a cacophony of cant, and at worst, much more sinister than that. But
Or if
leaving
not
that.
Kant, then at least Hegel.
Good, I like that. But leaving that to one side, I actually believe it is important to try and reach out. I mean, pick up the last copy of the New Criterion. Readers, listeners can't hear that, but I'm holding it up. If you look at that issue, I mean, I am absolutely delighted to see Woody Allen in it. You know, a really important figure. One American academic wrote to me and said, wasn't I disgusted to be alongside Woody Allen? And I said, no, I said, I feel honored to be alongside Woody Allen, somebody that has spent his life trying to make often quite difficult ideas accessible to people, which is, I think, what we should be trying to do. You and I are now currently, I wish we could do this more regularly. I would like you to feel that you could ask me more regularly to talk about cultural matters, because what I'm trying to do, not I don't have the answers, but I'm trying to avoid the easy answer of just agreeing with the norm, of assuming that there is a zeitgeist defined by the standard view, which at the moment happens to be the left, and that all we need to do is say, yes, there is a zeitgeist, and if people don't agree with the zeitgeist, as you and I don't, therefore we're in some way at best curious and redundant, and at worst some kind of academic or intellectual intervention. And I don't find that helpful. I mean, I found this again, I've got coming out with the British basis of Little Brown. I've got a history of America, a short history of America, in a series I've done of national histories. So I've also done, you know, France and Germany, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Britain. And in the history of America, I've tried to avoid the norms of how the academic would do it. Now, obviously, my background is I'm interested in, you know, how what is a source and all the rest of it. But actually, if you're looking at America, and you, as you may know, I earlier had done a book on America since the 60s, it's really useful to short circuit some of the standing things. Now, some of the points one could do are very curious. I mean, when I was doing Britain since the, sorry, America since the 60s. Part of the time I was in America and I was staying with people, and I was also working in libraries, on sometimes in archives, on much more other topics. But some of the sources one had, I mean, I remember I said to one of the academics I was staying in, I said, you know, I said, you look at all of these histories here of the United States, not a single one of them makes reference to a work of pornography. I ought to see a work of classic American pornography to see what I could make of it. So, you know, open-mindedly, I saw Debbie, I think it was Debbie Does Dallas, in which I commented on the fact about the characters smoking. And that gives you an idea how you can, you know, you can, as it were, look at a subject and see it in completely different ways. I mean, that's just a minor one, but my big history of America that's coming out, I've not written it from the assumption that it has to be east to west, and north to south. In other words, I've given a fair amount of attention, not to New England, but a fair amount of attention to the west and a fair amount to the south, which again is not. It's not generally what Brit writers on American history do, or even actually, it has to be said, what most American writers do.
Well, thank you for bringing up our February issue in which you appear. I think that every issue of the New Criterion is exceptional, but this was a really special issue. And as you mentioned, in addition to your own feature, we have Gary Saul Morrison on the history of Russian cosmism called Galaxy Brains. We have Joshua T. Katz on the importance of Homer. And as you say, a new story by Woody Allen, his first work of published fiction, as I understand it, that's been released in over a decade. And people say, well, How did you get Woody Allen? Why is Woody Allen writing for the new Criterion? And my answer is, why would you write for anywhere else but the new
I think that's
Criterion?
absolutely right. And can I just say for listeners, writers respond to the nature of a periodical. They really do. Writers are interested in words. They're interested in sentences, paragraphs, layout on the page, where they appear and how it is done. And the thing about the new Criterion is it has this astonishing capacity to, in my view, present the best of, I'm an 18th centuryist by background, the best of the 18th century magazine. The 18th century was the great age when magazines were launched in Britain, whether the Spectator and the Tatler or the Gentleman's Magazine, the Idler, all the famous magazines, all the famous writers, like Dr. Johnson, for example, or Richard Steele, all of them, Oliver Goldsmith, all of them were writing for that. And it seems to me that the new Criterion has that quality in which you focus on the prose. I mean, one of the features, of course, of the 18th century, because of the nature of print technology, is they were not illustrated. And therefore, you are much more concerned with the quality of the prose, and indeed also the layout on the page, and the typeface, than you would be today, when often in many magazines, it has to be said, the words are subordinate to both the advertisements and other illustrated material. So I think there's a powerful aesthetic that the new Criterion captures and that it brings out from writers. And I think the Woody Allen piece is very much that. I think the Homer piece is fascinating and important as an aspect of the continuity of public culture. The notion of the quest is really central to one of the, you know, psychological themes, because in Homer, you've got not just the collective quest of the Greeks trying to bring down Troy to bring back Helen, but you've also got the personal quest of Odysseus. And again, you know, through space, time, but also his personality. And that is fascinating. I mean, in some respects, it's a very odd way of looking at it. But in some respects, Huckleberry Finn is an American Odysseus.
Very much, very true. Well, and as you mentioned, the composition of every issue of the magazine, we spend a lot of time on the balance of what goes in. There is a conversation among all the pieces and all the writers. And so I'm very glad you bring that up.
One aspect that Americans possibly and Brits aren't aware of is that the publishing world is very much still one in which obviously America is the most important country in the world in terms of a free publishing world, though this freedom is being constrained by political correctness. But the Brits are also there. And books actually work generally if you can get a British publisher and an American publisher. So, for example, I've done two map books with the British Library, published in America by the University of Chicago Press, and another one has just been the University of Chicago Press has just signed up to it. I mean, you know, their readers have to be satisfied. It's not some tick exercise. But what that does is give one the enormous pleasure of knowing that somebody can read one's work in Des Moines as well as in Scunthorpe. And that's important because that's the nature of a public society in which we trust people. And that fundamentally is what a democratic culture is about. If you look at publishing, if you look at history in many countries in the world at the present moment, the historical world, the publishing world, the world of journals is a matter of what the party or the government says. And in a way, it is crucially important, and I'm not trying to be dramatic here, it is crucially important to the species that we go on producing quality discussion, quality work, quality explanation outside the orbit of government telling us what we can do, because the latter way is the way in which we will narrow the species and we will turn into a palimpsest of some ghastly autocracy.
Well, that's a very important concluding statement. Thank you so much. You've been listening to The New Criterion. I'm James Panero. My guest today is Jeremy Black, prolific historian and frequent contributor to our pages His latest article for the magazine is his feature River of Destinies on the role of the Thames in England's fortunes, which appears in the February 2024 issue. And next up for us from you is a review of Simon Heffer's Sing As We Go, Britain Between the Wars, which will appear this spring. Jeremy Black, thank you for your many contributions to our pages and for joining us today.
Thank you. And I must say how delighted I am about this my link with it. And I am delighted that the new Criterion is still going. And if anybody listening to this is a would-be or potential subscriber, let me urge them to subscribe. This is a civilizationally important periodical.
Thank you so much.